Good evening.
Hi. My name is Marvin McDonald, and I'm the director of the Counseling Psychology Program here at Trinity Western, and it's my privilege to welcome you all here this evening. Thank you for joining us. This is part of the open house that we're holding this year. The event this evening is a lecture on the life of Viktor Frankl. A number of people asked about the nature of the advertisement, and so the content occasionally came across as an emphasis on grief. So those contents we'll see as the evening unfolds, okay? But I wanted to, first of all, just very briefly just mention to you all that we're privileged to have Dr. Alfred Lengle from Vienna. He is the president of the International Society for Logotherapy and Existential Analysis. He is an international leader in promoting not only the therapeutic work, but also the research and the broader community work that results from and is one of the primary legacies of the work of Dr. Frankl. So we'll have a few opportunities. One of the things I'm supposed to do and to remind us for the process is to point out to all of us that we have two microphones that are set up at the front of each of the aisles, including the one I'm using here. The purpose for this is that we'll have a chance to ask questions after Dr. Lengle's lecture, and we would like to record the questions as well as his responses. So I'll try to remind us when we get to that point in the evening, but I'll ask people, when you're thinking of coming for questions, if you'd come forward and speak your questions with the microphones. So it's also the point to give you a chance to think of this as an opportunity for more interaction. So you might want to keep those questions that are floating in the presentation and keep track of them so that you'll have a chance to join into discussion later on. Okay? Fair enough. So without further ado, Dr. Lengle, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Marvin. Thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm coming here from Vienna to talk to you about a man who was famous, who belonged to the world, not only to Vienna, who was an international speaker and a world-famous psychotherapist, Viktor Frankl. I'm very grateful to have got this invitation and this kind introduction by Marvin, and I'm happy and feel honored to be here, and I look really forward to share this evening with you with a person, with an outstanding person whom we put in the middle of this evening. I hope you can follow my English and my Viennese accent, and if there are any questions or if you don't understand anything, please don't hesitate to ask, and I think we can easily share and communicate in this room. When we talk about someone's life, there are two questions arising normally. The first one, who is this person? And the second one, what for did he live? And these two questions are very apt for introducing Viktor Frankl. Who was this man and what did he live for? Who was it? This question points towards anthropology and concept of man and knowing a little bit more about a person and personality and what he is thinking and feeling and what attitudes he has and what is moving him. And Viktor Frankl, one of his central points in his life was the development of a concept of man and anthropology and its application in psychotherapy to overcome reductionism in psychotherapy and psychology, to reinstall the complete human being with all his dimensions, with his not only his bodily and psychic dimension, but also with his spiritual dimension, with his capacity of making choices, decisions, his taking over responsibility, and his search of meaning. And this leads to the other point: what was this man living for? He lived for a central theme which went over his entire life, the theme of search of meaning. Well, meaning is a concept which gives orientation in one's life. And without meaning, we are in a danger that we cannot support and endure difficult life situations. This is the survival value of meaning, that we are strengthened when we have a meaning, when we have a why we live for, that we are strong enough in that case to endure the most difficult life situations. And Viktor Frankl's life is a paradigm, an example of this power of human spirit. And I'm going to talk to you this evening about this man. Who was Viktor Frankl? Let's start with this first question. You see a picture of him here on that screen. He was a Viennese man, born in Vienna, he died in Vienna. He lived almost a whole century. It's a very long life. I have another short picture which shows him a little bit stronger, more the intellectual type in this picture. This is the picture on the cover of the book I have written about him. It is written in German, and there's only a Spanish translation, but not no English one. Not yet. And when we start to enter the life of this man who passed almost his entire life in Vienna, I would like to take you first into a little walk through Vienna. Derek Klassen was so kind and kind enough to put some pictures from the internet and put it together here. This first map shows where Vienna is lying in the midst of Central Europe. You see here Austria, the Lake of Constance, Germany, Munich, Italy, Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia, Hungary, Slovakia, Ukraine. It is in the midst, Ukraine, and it's not far from Vienna to the capital of Ukraine. It's about 1,000 kilometers, and from Vienna to Munich it's 400 kilometers. To Berlin it's 700 kilometers. So we are in the center of Europe. And in the center of Vienna is the famous tower of the cathedral, of St. Stephen's Cathedral, a Gothic tower, St. Charles Church. Just to have a look, to convey to you a little bit the air of Vienna, the waltzes and the parliament, the major Schönbrunn, the castle. I'm living very close to this castle, only 300 yards. I feel like at home. And here we are with the young Frankl, a century back from now. Professionally, the founder of logotherapy was a physician, a neurologist and psychiatrist. He was also a psychologist. He acquired a PhD after World War II. With his innate sense of humor, we'll be coming back to that sense of humor several times this evening. He commented the fact of having two doctorates often by saying that people in Vienna certainly may not think that I am a double doctor, but only instead a half a physician. This is the negative comment he is thinking that Viennese have in their heart. Frankl also was head of the Department of Neurology in the Vienna Polyclinic and professor for neurology and psychiatry at the Vienna University Medical School. As far as to his outer appearance, how did it look like? He was a short man, about 5.5 feet only of height, full of life, vigorous, with strikingly vivacious eyes. He always gave the impression of being firm in his attitude, convinced in his actions and clear in his thinking. An extraordinary man. A brilliant mind, sparkling with wit, full of humor, and always ready, in a very characteristic way, to crack jokes that suited the situation but created some distance, or to pursue such strains of thought. Since he was meticulous in everything and applied the same attention to small as to big things, he sometimes found himself in a quandary. He was meticulous not only by nature but also by attitude. He said the recipe of his success he has seen in the fact that he conveyed the same sorrow and accurateness to the small things as to the great things in his life. He didn't make a difference in being engaged and committed. So, on the other hand, it has had a shadow, and it was sometimes very difficult for him. When I called him, for example, I tell you a story how this being meticulous could work. When I called him, for example, to ask when I could come the same evening to see him, he answered, after a while, you could come around 8 o'clock. That would be best. But wait a minute, he started to think. And after a while he said, no, better you come at 7:15. You know, then we have enough time to talk, and at 7:30 there will be the news on the TV, and then we have only 15 minutes. Would you mind to watch the TV news with me? But I cannot ask you for that. But if you are interested, that would be fine. But better you come at 7:50. Then the TV news are over, and we are free and can talk. But isn't it too late for you if you come 7:50? You must go home back afterwards, and and so on. And this shows how particular Frankl was about detail, and how much he did not only think about himself and his own interest, but also for others. In spite of my obliging and reassuring answer, he would interrupt me, and maybe you better come at 7:50 when the news are over, then we can talk without interruption. Like this, he would go on for minutes in order to finally come up to an anecdote. He realized that he was really walking on the place and not moving forward, and he then always took an anecdote or a joke or something to bring himself out of the situation. And he told me the anecdote not even having fixed the time when I should come, we were already talking 10 minutes about this. And he was saying, this is like my boss Kauders, who was equally unable to come to a decision. Just like me, he wanted to make the best use of his time and still take everything into consideration, which of course is impossible. When I once asked him about a date, the same thing happened as between us now, until he finally said, so what, come whenever you want. And I am going to say the same thing to you now, come whenever you want. And then for years, it was with this saying that he answered my question when I should come, and both we were laughing because we knew what was the background. The family. Frankl, these words were about Frankl as a personality, but where does he come from? What is the family background? Frankl was descendant from a pious Jewish family. His mother was herself descendant from an aristocratic Pragian family with High Rabbi Löw as an ancestor of the 16th century. Frankl described his mother as warm and good from her heart. He denominated her the personalized goodness. The experience with his father was different. Frankl described him as being the contrary to his mother. And finally he said that he has been more the father and much more the father than his mother. Committed to duty and faith, Spartanic, economical but not miserly or stingy, pedantic up to stubbornness. Frankl thought that he had inherited that character of his father, and more than this, he was also educated in the same perfectionism by his father. The father forced him and his brother, for instance, to read loudly a prayer in Hebrew, and whenever they made a mistake, they lost a reward of 10 hellers or cents at that time. But anyway, he got these cents only a few times in his life. Although the father was normally calm and stoic, he had a violent temper. Once he broke a walking stick on Victor's back while thrashing him. It was before World War I, in 1910, 1912, 1914. Nevertheless, Frankl was strongly attached to his family and to his parents. Imagine, at the age of 25 and even older, he got homesick in the one night he had to pass in the hospital as a physician. When he was on duty. Homesick when he couldn't sleep in the home of his parents. This is very rare in that age. The young Victor, at the age of 3 and on, got the nickname Bucky. In German, Bucky. This means because of his stubbornness and his being sulky. He must have been a terrible child with 3 years, 4 years, with a strong own will. He had a strong own will in his entire life, and it was difficult to confront his will, and so it was not always easy to live in the near to him with such a will. But already at 3 years, he showed this strength, this probably spiritual strength and personality strength. And I'm mentioning this because I find it very interesting in a house of counseling psychology, and where we have an open day, open house today, because it shows tendencies toward denying and putting borders with a strong feeling for their own goals and for what one wants to do. Decades later, Frankl will formulate the theory of logotherapy and force the strength of the will and the defiant power of the human spirit, the Trotzmacht des Geistes in German. One can assume that this personality had natural tendencies toward this type of theory. And this is always interesting, to see how a theory is connected to a personality and to his own tendencies and strengths and also weak points. Let us continue to talk about the young Victor. You see him in the middle here. This is Victor, his older brother Walter, and his sister Stella. In the age of about, he was about 4 at this, when this picture was taken. In this age of 4, Frankl remembered later that he once woke up with a start shortly after falling asleep because he got aware that one day he has to die. This is rare. At least that people remember that they had this fear or these thoughts. It was not the finiteness itself, he was saying later, which scared him, but, as he knew later, the question if the transitoriness of life would not destroy the meaning of his life. It was already at this age the connection of what is life good for if I have to die, if it is so limited? Frankl had an early and never-ending interest in the meaning of life. At 13, he heard his chemistry teacher saying that life is nothing but a process of oxidation. Frankl sprang to his feet and passionately disagreed by asking him, but what then is the meaning of life? And this is already a form of reductionism. Life is nothing but a oxidational process. Well, of course, every life takes some energy from somewhere and is related to oxidation. But to reduce the whole life only to this fact is not being correct to the whole empire of life, to the whole wildness of life. This concern at reductionism and nihilism was intensified when one of his school companions was found having committed suicide with a book by Friedrich Nietzsche at his hand. Thank you very much. The concern to reductionism and nihilism should become the central theme in his life. He understood logotherapy as a systematic concept to overcome reductionism in psychology and psychotherapy. And for years, he meditated every morning before getting up in his bed a couple of minutes about the meaning of this day and the last day, and every day also about the meaning of his life. He was really concerned personally to find out his personal meaning, and not only in general, but also situated in the daily life. With 14, and here we see a picture of already a little older Frankl, Victor is at the right from our, yeah, this is Victor and his parents, brother and sister. This is written, I see, 1910. It cannot be true, because Victor was born in 1905, and this is not look doesn't look like a 5-year-old boy. Well, at 14, Victor started to read Freud, and he assisted courses on Sigmund Freud. And at that time, Freud and his thinking was a very novel thing in Vienna and a very revolutionary thing. It was not accepted by the officials at the university, not accepted by the majority of physicians. There were hard debates against Sigmund Freud, with the saying that Freud is a anarchist, is a sexualist, is reducing humanness, and so on. And the young Victor, a rebel, already at 14, a member of the socialist students and high school students, and later on the chief. For 1 year he was boss of the socialist high school students. And this rebellious young man became a adherent of Sigmund. Whenever Frankl has read something which he thought could be of interest for Sigmund Freud, he copied it, or he took the journal and sent it to Sigmund Freud with the comment, just for your interest, it may be helpful for you, and so on. This is also typical for Frankl, this helpful and committed attitude. Whenever he could do something for a better, he did not hesitate to do it. And it is unusual for a boy of, a youngster of 15, 16, even 17 years to write to a kind of an outlawed person and to send them that material. And on the other hand, on the other side, Sigmund Freud answered each of his letters within 48 hours. This is also a sign of the correctness of this this genius. And it shows a little bit the atmosphere of Vienna of that time, to be very on duty, very correct, very stiff in a way and formal, but really hard at work. And at the time there were no emails and Freud and answered all, wrote all his letters at that time with a pen, with a real pen with ink. So, you know, not a ball pen. So it is much more work to write. Well, after having finished high school and entered university, he asked Freud in one of his letters if he can undertake training in psychoanalysis. And Freud conveyed him to Paul Federn, the secretary general at that time of the Psychoanalytic Society in Vienna. Paul Federn invited him for an interview, and I'm telling this story because for me it's the hour of birth for logotherapy. Paul Federn invited Frankl for an interview. Frankl arrived, a servant opened the door and brought him in. Federn was sitting at his desk writing something, and Frankl was standing there at the door. The servant went out, and Frankl stood there for some minutes, and Federn continued quietly writing, without moving, without saying anything. And then after a while, he raised his head, looked at him, showed, without seeing any word, showed him the place to sit down on a chair, sat down at the chair, and then his first question was, "Well, Mr. Frankl, what's your neurosis?" Frankl was in a kind surprised by this question, and he was also prepared and gave his answer, which he has prepared at home already and spoke about in psychoanalytic terms about his tendencies towards compulsory tendencies and so on, and spoke about his neurotic tendencies. He knew. After the interview, Frankl went out. He was dizzy in a way. He didn't feel at ease, and he went for a walk along the Danube and the channel of the Danube. And in this hour is the birth hour, or the hour of birth for logotherapy, in my opinion. In this hour, he discovered what made him these uneasy feelings. And he remembered the situation when he entered. And first he had to wait, and Phaedon wasn't saying nothing. And then he didn't say any greeting. There was no atmosphere of humanness, no naturalness. Of course, Frankl knew, and we all know why Phaedon did it. Phaedon was not an inhuman person. He was a very human and very nice person. But in a psychoanalysis, you may not establish any relationship besides a neutral relationship. And at that time, it was very strong. It is for the classical psychoanalysts, it's up to now. There are many other psychoanalysts. But to be neutral means to show nothing personal, just being a neutral screen where the patient can project his neurotic feelings, his neurotic tendencies, which then can be treated. This is an important part of the psychoanalytic setting, and Phaedon was correct, and very correct for this psychoanalytic setting. But Frankl felt that a psychotherapy which needs to work with such a setting is subhuman, is offending the person, is making these traumas, which they pretend to heal afterwards. This is a saying of Karl Kraus, a very famous Viennese writer and journalist. So that was his definition, a very famous definition of the late 20s already. And Frankl felt that subhumanness is a reductionism, and we must not do reductionism in setting, not even in a setting situation, spare the real psychotherapeutic process. Reductionism, and then the first question was a specialized type of reductionism, namely pathologism. He was not asking, "What are you interested for? Why do you think? Do you want to undergo a psychoanalytic training? What's your motivation?" and so on. And what do you see as valuable or so? He was asking, and he was asking after his neurosis, and not even questioning, do you think you have any neurosis? No, it was obvious for him, as in psychoanalytic theory, it was obvious that everyone has his neurosis until he is treated psychoanalytically. So Frankl didn't feel himself ill. And this making people to patients, this was the second feeling. He was felt defied, and he wanted to oppose. And in this walk, in this stroll along the channel of the Danube channel, he decided not to start with the psychoanalytic training, but to change over to another man, another famous psychotherapist in Vienna, the founder of the second school, Viennese school of psychotherapy, Alfred Adler. Here, this was Sigmund Freud. Frankl had the opportunity to meet him once, only once, face by face. Also, Frankl was living not so far from Sigmund Freud, where Freud was living. Here is the university. Here is that church, which you can see here, the Votive Church, where Frankl met by chance Sigmund Freud. And Freud was living in this street, Berggasse 19, here. And Frankl was living here, in the second district, in the Czerningasse 2. So this is, by air, it is a distance of about 2 kilometers, let's say. Well, they met each other just in front of. Am I doing something wrong with the microphone, or is it? Yeah. Well, we can communicate and also without microphone. They met here, and Frankl has seen an older man with a stick in the head and a dark coat walking this little bow, walking in the direction from the Votive Church in direction to the Berggasse. And this old man he has seen was always chewing like this and nervously chewing. Victor, as you know, Sigmund Freud was suffering from a cancer in the mouth and had already undergone several operations. And Frankl knew that. And from this he figured out that this probably could be Sigmund Freud. He followed Sigmund Freud a little bit, his person a little bit, and when he had seen that he really turned into the Berggasse, he was quite sure, and he went up to the man and asked him, excuse me, sir, am I right? Do I have the honor, Viennese style, do I have the honor to speak to Professor Freud? And Freud answered, yes, this I am. Well, my name is Viktor Frankl. And Freud raised the head and said by heart, Czerningasse 2, second district. This was the address where Freud has answered all his letters, and he knew it by heart. And this also shows this tremendous memory of this man who just had it like this to say the address. Frankl at that time was already a follower, was already with Alfred Adler, and he commented this meeting with Freud, he liked to comment it by saying that this was the only situation I was a real follower of Sigmund Freud, because I followed him into Berggasse 19. With Adler was also a scholar of Sigmund Freud, but has been separated from him because of another concept and understanding of psychotherapy. The main motivation for Adler was not so long the sexual or libidinal thrives, but for Adler it was the overcoming the inferiority complex. And he had a more social psychology. Also, the name of his psychology was Individualpsychologie, individual psychology. He was a very political and social psychologist. He personally was an adherent of the Rush Revolution, a friend of Trotsky, married with a Russian woman, and had all these revolutionary communists and Trotskyists in his house. And Frankl himself, being a social part of the Socialist Party, felt much more at home with Alfred Adler, also for the political commitment and engagement. And so he decided to do his training at with Alfred Adler and his disciples. Here you see Alfred Adler, a mighty man, here from the front. 1927, Frankl finished his studies with Adler and completed his training in 27. And in this year he had the chance to give a public talk at the third international conference of the Adlerians in Düsseldorf. And in this talk, in this lecture, he started with his fight against reductionism, and right at the beginning of his professional career, he was saying that for him, neurosis is not only the patient with the neurotic patient is not only a neurotic but also a human being. This means that the neurotic is not only looking after secondary advantage of his neurosis, like binding his partner in a so-called neurotic arrangement, for instance in a cardiac phobia. But besides of this, the neurotic patient is acting also as a person, not only as a neurotic. Thus, neurotic behavior has not only to be seen as a symptom of a disorder, but also as an expression of a person in the search of understanding, of meaning, an expression of his need. This position led to the exclusion of Viktor Frankl from the Adlerian movement in 1928. At that time, Frankl had already installed a network of free consulting for young people, together with Alexandra Adler, the daughter of Alfred Adler, Charlotte Bühler, who is probably known in the United States. She also lived in the United States later on. Egon Wexberg, a famous psychoanalyst, and so on. The result of this network for consulting network for young people, free consulting, was that for the first time since the World War I, there was no committed suicide by a scholar in the end of a school year. There were every year suicides, and they attained that goal that the rate was dropped to zero. Well, after having after having been excluded from the Adlerian movement, a decade of crisis started in his life. Frankl had almost no possibility to do psychotherapy, and he committed himself to the neurological work. He he worked mainly as a neurologist and psychiatrist in the following 10 years. But besides of this exclusion, the was the time when the Nazis already came up. It was the underground movement of the Nazis, and in this time it was forbidden to Frankl as a Jewish person to give public talks and to publish on psychotherapy. No Jews were permitted to talk publicly or to publish. They could ask questions in the first years, but then after the takeover of the Nazis, they aren't even allowed to ask publicly questions in a public talk. So Frankl was reduced from outside very heavily, and at the same time, from the inner side, from within, he came into a crisis. He fell into what he later on described an existential vacuum. What is an existential vacuum? Existential vacuum, in the understanding of Frankl, is a deep feeling of inner void and meaninglessness with the symptoms of apathy and loss of interest. The reaction of a existential vacuum is the trial to fill the void with either search for reactive to the central motivation, which for him was the meaning. Years of sexual affairs with women followed, no fixed relationship. He was also gaining power in the medical hierarchy as assistant medical director first, and then already under the Nazis as medical director in the Rothschild Hospital, which was a Jewish hospital in Vienna at that time, which nowadays doesn't exist anymore. This picture here shows Frankl at that time. You see him sitting doing a lumbar puncture, and behind Victor is standing his best friend Paul Pollack, also a psychiatrist and neurologist. And Frankl liked very much this medical work, and he was always dreaming of neurological operations, brain operations. This was for him a real challenge, and in this time he also did brain operations, which in the last years was theme of discussion of Frankl's ethical attitude towards patient, if he did use or did not use patients for training in operation and so on. In my opinion, it was absolutely in the mainstream of the time, and in this time some kinds of operations were done which nowadays nobody would do, but at that time many people and most neurologists did it just because one did not know that much about what's going on in these operations. Well, the difficult time went over when he met a beautiful woman, a nurse, yes, than himself. She was 20 at that time, Tilly. Tilly was his great love in his life, and his let's say first love also. This love restructured his life. Frankl started again with writing and reading, And in already under the Nazis in the 38 was the beginning of the war, and he met Tilly at 1940, and in this time he started also to write for the first time his book, his central book on logotherapy. In you see the tremendous power of love, not only the tremendous power of the defiant power of human spirit, but the even stronger power of love on humans. And with Tilly he was very happy, and he got inspired and got back all his old forces, and was so able to write down his logotherapy. He wrote down logotherapy because he was not no longer in any psychotherapeutic movement, and being so alone, he decided to write down what he was thinking to be the best way to raise the human potentials in men and to reduce reductionism. The intention was not to found a new psychotherapeutic. The intention was to develop a tool applicable for all psychotherapeutic movements to install and work with the human potentials. But at the beginning, this was... Well, Victor applied for a visa for the United States to come out of the Nazi Austria and Nazi Germany. He got the visa already at the time when he was still under protection. As long as he was head of the department in the Jewish hospital, he and his family got a protection against deportation into the death camps and the concentration camps. But he felt at the beginning of 42 that this was no longer secure. You know, the Wannsee Conference had been at the beginning of 42, and the radical era of extermination of Jewish people had already started, and Frankl felt that there was becoming up more and more insecurity, and so he applied and got a visa for the United States. This brought him into a great difficulty. What should he do? Now he was free, he could leave Austria and Vienna whenever he wanted. But if he leaves Vienna, this would mean that his parents were alone, his sister already left Vienna and went over Mexico later on to Australia. His brother was in Vienna, but he was married. And what should he do? He had his logotherapy in mind. He has written down the ärztliche Seelsorge, translated in English, the title is The Doctor and the Soul, the first book on logotherapy. And he knew when he goes out, he has before him a career, an academic career. He has the responsibility to spread this thinking. But on the other hand, he has the responsibility for his family and for his parents especially. And for Tilly. So he, for months, weeks and months, he couldn't really decide. And finally he knew that the time is shortly run out if he doesn't decide. And in his need, he entered the St. Stephen's Cathedral, which was forbidden to him because he was a Jewish man, and Jewish people had a big yellow star on their clothes that everyone can see from from far distant that this is a Jewish person. He just took his map he had in hand this way to cover the star and entered St. Stephen's Cathedral just for having an hour for himself and to have a spiritual atmosphere to come to a decision. And there was a brilliant organ concert. Somebody was playing organ and he listened to that concert and he went out and still undecision and still really depressed and not knowing where to go. And this evening he came home from St. Stephen's, came home to his parents and sat down. Then he has seen a white stone in the house over the radio, and he looked at it and asked his father, "What's that stone? That wasn't here when I left in the morning." The father said, "Well, I found this stone. This is a in the second night before the, in the Kristallnacht, when the Nazis destroyed the Jewish temples, also this temple, their temple, was destroyed. And I found this marble stone and I took it home just for as a souvenir." And Frankl took that stone and looked at it and has seen a part of a Hebrew sign. What is this sign? Do you know what this marble stems from? And his father, Frankl, didn't know it. He just could read a little bit. Answered, "Well, this is a marble, a part of the commandments. And do you know which commandment is from which commandment it comes from?" Frankl said, "No, I can't discern it." And his father was saying, he answered, "Well, there is only one commandment in which this sign is in. And this is the fourth commandment. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you." In that moment, Frankl was shocked. He got the answer. He got the answer in his deciding process. And he took it as a hint of the heaven, as he always was saying, that he may not, he must not leave his parents alone. And he decided to stay in Vienna and let go the visa. And so he did. A week or two later, he got married with Tilly. And he was saying that this was a kind of a present to him for remaining in Vienna. Well, the year, shortly after that, about 2 months later, he came into the concentration camp with all the family. For 2.5 years, he lived in 4 different concentration camps. 42, 45, he was. The first concentration camp was a good one. It was the best concentration camp the Nazis has developed. It was the concentration camp which was officially designed for the public and for the Red Cross.
Excuse me, the technical difficulties of today. The first concentration camp was that of Theresienstadt, Theresien, in between of Prague and Dresden.
This concentration camp was one which has been shown to foreigners, and there were sometimes delegates from Geneva, from other countries who visited that concentration camp, and Hitler was selling the foreigners the idea that he is constructing cities properly for Jewish people where they can live and do their arts for themselves and not being disturbed any longer. Such a crazy idea, but he did it, and in Theresienstadt he did he constructed a camp with many, many freedoms. There were libraries, there were theater playing, there was music playing, there were nice barracks, and Frankl was living in a genius barrack, as it was called, where the doctors lived, and he was doctor in that Theresienstadt, and he had the opportunity to meet his wife twice a week, or also privately during the day, and so it was not that bad at the beginning, but at the end it was terrible. From Theresienstadt he came into death camps, Auschwitz. 1 week he was in Auschwitz in a death camp. Theresienstadt was no death camp. From there people came, were transported to Auschwitz, but in Theresienstadt almost nobody was killed. But in Auschwitz, this 1 week, he lost his mother, as he didn't know at the time, but later on he learned it. And from there he came to Dachau and then to Kaufering. And it was several times by chance that he overcame death. And he was so sick once from a typhus that he was nearly dead, and thanks to his strong will he overcame this hard situation. He knew when he was falling asleep he wouldn't wake up any longer, because he was losing all his water, his bodily water, by diarrhea, and he must have been awake. But how can one make himself awake when all the forces are losing? And so he stamped himself in his plank bed and made him hurt for not falling asleep, and then he concentrated and wrote with a small pencil the restructuring of the doctor and the soul, his book for about logotherapy. And he was living for that and hoping that he can at least let back, in case he will die, some thoughts, some ideas about his main work. So you see, this is Frankl, the nucleus, the hardcore of this person, it also shows the strength of the human spirit to overcome even the worst situation. You must imagine, they lived in those bad camps. There were plank beds 2 for 2 meters, 5 to 6 men sleeping on that, on the pure wood. And the pillows were their shoes, and fleas and bed bugs were the common guests, the common cohabitants. And they were all hungry. And an incredible smell in the barracks, and so on. And for weeks and months he had to live in such a situation. And in this situation, he also had the typhus. How can one overcome such an extreme life situation? What helped Victor to overcome it, to keep himself alive. First, it was his work, his wish to continue to rewrite rewrite The Doctor and the Soul, his central work on logotherapy. He was really in a fever for that. He hoped to accomplish it. The manuscript of The Doctor and the Soul was the only thing he took with him into the concentration camp. And for not losing it, it was sewed into his coat. But when he arrived at Theresienstadt, at the first concentration, no, later at Auschwitz, when he arrived there, the first thing all the people have to do were to tear off all the clothes, and they were taken away, and also the manuscript was lost. And so he knew that he has to rewrite it, and this was one thing he lived for in the concentration camp, the hope to being able to accomplish his life task. The second thing he lived for was his love. He really hoped to be able to join again his wife and his mother. His father was already dead. His father died in Theresienstadt, and Frankl could accompany him into death, and until the last night he was with him. He didn't have any notice about his brother and about his sister, but he hoped to meet all these again, especially his mother. He was very attached to his mother and his wife. And the third thing which helped him to overcome the situation was praying and believing in God as the super meaning, as this meaning which encompasses everything in our life. And he felt guided by God, and he took a lot of strength from this. This is interesting. These are the three things you can find, the three motivations you can find in his book, Man's Search for Meaning. If you read it thoroughly, and I have studied it for a long time, you find these three motivations as being central for overcoming this situation. And this is, in a way, also important for logotherapy, this theoretical thinking Viktor Frankl developed, because this is an empirical validation of the tenets of logotherapy. These are the three main roads to meaning, as he is describing in his logotherapy. The first, values, creative values, thank you. The second, the experiential values, and the third, the attitudinal values. Creative values, that we live for something that or meaning derives from living for something where we are active, creative, where we do something, where we work, and where we write a letter, where we do a talk to somebody, where we wash dishes, whatever it is, where we do something and create a value. The second, the experiential values, where we experience some valuable thing, where we experience nature, culture, art, love, encounter another person, fresh air, sunshine, rain, whatever, where we experience something valuable, where we take over values. And for him it was especially the love to mainly those two women, Tilly and his mother. Work, love, and pray. Attitudinal values, the third type of values in logotherapy, says that in desperate situations where you cannot do anything, where you cannot perform any valuable thing because you are too sick, you are too old, you are too crazy or too weak or too sick, I was saying already. Then what can you do then? You can't produce anything, neither can you experience values. In that situation, there's still one possibility left, the possibility to take a stand to whatever happens. But taking a stand, taking an attitude towards these terrible situations means that you must be grounded, that you must have some inner relation to the value of life itself. And this goes over and leads a religious person also to the living the love of God. But a not religious person would restrict himself and say, I am holding up the value of life, of just being here. And you see, in the center, Frankl has lived logotherapy, and logotherapy helped him to overcome this situation. The meaning here showed turned to be not only meaning, but not only a value, but a survival value for him. And as the famous sentence of Nietzsche is saying, Frankl experienced this exactly in the concentration camp. Nietzsche once was saying, he who has a why to live can endure almost anyhow. He who has a why to live. And Frankl had three whys to live: work, love, and God. Then you can endure almost anyhow. Frankl lost all his relatives in the concentration camp. Already during the concentration camp, he became at least two times pretty depressive. He was writing about this more in a paper which is not edited and which he gave me once. And it is showing that even such a strong person with such a strong will, you remember the 3 years old boy, and you see that man with that strong will which helped him to overcome the situation. Even such a man, full of meaning, centered around meaning, became depressive. He was desperate, and once an actor of Munich set aside of him when he had seen him depressive, not eating, giving him his soup, saying, eat, you must eat. And under the help of this actor, he ate, and he continued. And another time, somebody else was talking to him in a second depression. And so he was able, with the help of other people, to overcome the worst life situations he had. Probably the worst. It wasn't yet the worst. It was bad enough. And this is so important that we take this from Frankl. Take this notion that even such a giant in meaning and will can become depressive and needs help from others. And this is important for any psychological work, but not only for psychologists. Every one of us can be in situations where he is not able to overcome that situation in a good way, where we need others. So don't hesitate to ask others to go to others, to enter a talk, an encounter. Because we are social beings. We need the encounter, we need the contact, we need the relationship, and we need the spiritual help and the love of other people. When Frankl came out of the concentration camp in May 45, he was celebrating this day of liberation every year throughout his whole life. And he was celebrating it by not eating the whole day, because he was almost starving by hunger, and for remembering what he has undergone, he was not eating his liberation day. He came out, and after a couple of weeks he came back to Vienna. He was liberated by Americans, by Texan troops, and he was very much attached to the Texans since then. And once he was in Texas and thanked them in a moving speech for their liberation. And yeah, he came to Vienna, back to Vienna, and within a couple of days he learned that all his relatives were dead. Mother died, Tilly died probably the very day of liberation by starving by hunger. She, as people told Frankl, she probably was so weak that she couldn't resist the pressure of the group who went to the door when it was opened, and she fell down and was trampled. Yeah. So this is a very, very tragic, and he, again, this is the worst time in Frankl's life. These days, there was no home in Vienna, and many friends, many good friends died. There were some good friends left, some not Jewish friends who still lived in Vienna. Some of them were in the SA, were Nazis, but they helped Frankl, they protected him, they invited him before he went to the concentration camp. Whenever he needs help, he can sleep at them at home, and he would be perfectly safe because they were Nazis, and nobody would suspect that Nazis protect Jewish people. And so you see how different people are. He found friends. He found two friends who helped him enormously. One was a very practical politician, later on of the Socialist Party, who said to him in this depression, "Victor, you must write down what you experienced." He gave him a typing machine, but Victor was not able to type. The other friend was Paul Pollack, we see in this picture, the psychiatrist. And he helped him a lot by talking. And what was going on? Frankl, for overcoming the Nazi trauma, he finally, after about 2-3 weeks of depression, he started to write down what he experienced in the concentration camp. Within 9 days, he dictated the whole book, Man's Search for Meaning. He used 3 shorthand typists at once, and in between he was weeping and crying. Then he drank dark tea to overcome the exhaustion. It was the hardest therapy he ever had. But it helped him a lot. It was this book he wanted to edit anonymously. And when the cover was already printed, friends told him and convinced him that he should indicate his name. And in the first edition, you see the cover without his name, and in the inside, you see the name the name Viktor Frankl. This book, he was saying, which he was intending to edit anonymously, made him so famous. Only in the United States, there were 10 million copies sold up to now. It is one of the 10 most influential books of the United States. It's a long seller. It is has been translated in over 20 languages. It is a document of what human beings are capable of, what we persons and subjects are capable to do, to perform, to endure, and how we suffer when we lose meaning. He describes persons who died because they have given them up, themselves up. Well, in the this was 45, and still in 45, he started to rewrite The Doctor and the Soul with these little notices he made in the concentration camp, which helped him. They are preserved in the Viktor Frankl archive until now. 1946, Doctor and the Soul appeared, and but this book again, this book didn't make a great selling history at the beginning. Also, the Man's Search for Meaning was sold within 3 days, and there was no paper to reprint it, and it needed a couple of weeks for having a next edition. Doctor and the Soul became the central work for logotherapy, and it is up to now. And also in 46, another chapter of his life opened. He met a nurse again in the hospital he was working. Ellie was her name. He saw her, and he saw her eyes and fell in love immediately when he had seen these lively eyes. He was stroken by them, and the next year they got married in 47. Now a period started where Frankl lectured the whole world. He was invited by over 200 universities worldwide to give lectures on logotherapy and on trauma therapy and psychology of extreme situations. He was over 80 times, had over 80 lecture tours done to the United States alone. So he was so busy in this time. And one lecture tour sometimes lasted up to 6 weeks, 2 months, with daily lectures traveling from one city to the other. Logotherapy became the third Viennese school of psychotherapy after Freud and Adler. Frankl has written 31 books, and which were translated in 42 languages. And he has got the incredible number of 28 honorary doctor degrees. Imagine, there are few people who have one doctor degree. And very few who have two or three. But 28, I was asking many people who are familiar with these academic degrees, and nobody knows anyone who had ever had so many honorary doctor degrees. When you see this tremendous work, and when you see how helpful it was for Frankl to overcome the concentration camp, you know what he lived for. He has seen his task in finding meaning, in helping people to find meaning. He was describing himself in this way. He was asked, Viktor Frankl, what were you living for? What is the meaning for your life? Then he answered in his witty way, and at the same time deep manner and humorous way, he was saying and giving us an enigma by saying, the meaning of my life was to help other people to find meaning. So he got many honors. He was honorary member of the Austrian Academy of Science and so on. And he had personal encounters with many people. Here you see an encounter with Martin Heidegger. In the home of Martin Heidegger, the bookshelves of Martin Heidegger. And Heidegger was saying to Frankl in this encounter, I have read all your books, but this one, and he pointed up here on the left of him, about here, this one, Man's Search for Meaning, is the best of all. He met Karl Jaspers, another philosopher, German philosopher, in the home of Jaspers. He had a private audience at the Pope Paul VI. Here you see Frankl's wife behind, Ellie. Frankl was so moved when he has seen the face of this Pope, who had great difficulties because of his encyclical Humanae Vitae and his stand against the pill, the conception, how do you say, the birth control, yeah. And then he has seen a man who really was responsible for what he was doing. And when he went out, Paul VI was saying to him, please pray for me. This was moving him, was moving Frankl very much. He was also meeting Binswanger, Maslow, Carl Rogers, Moreno. Then he had political encounters. He was invited by Miss Eisenhower and invited to her home. He met the last Habsburgian, Otto von Habsburg, in several meetings. And he once met Hillary Clinton when she was in Vienna. It was the last political encounter, because we are in North America. I'm talking a little bit about this just before we come to the end. Mrs. Clinton was in Vienna and gave a banquet and had a special wish, which she conveyed to to her ambassador. She wanted to meet Viktor Frankl. She has read Man's Search for Meaning in high school and always had the wish to meet him personally. And now she had the power that she could invite him, and she did so. And Frankl came to that banquet. This was the last showing up in an official political context. And when he arrived at the banquet, he had a conversation with Hillary, surrounded by many people. And Frankl, in his witty and humorous manner, addressed the group around them by saying, you are a witness of this moving trial of this lady to make me patient of my own being a doctor, patient of megalomania. He felt that he felt greater than he was just by being invited by the First Lady of the United States. So he was anxious that he become megalomaniac, and he has to be patient. And since he is a psychiatrist, he should have to treat himself personally. Frankl fought for the one mankind for the becoming more and more person with one's own responsibility and meaning. After the war, he fought the concept of collective guilt. He was witness in the proceedings and trials in favor for many former Nazis because they have helped him or others. It was the human dimension which counted for him, not the adherence to any party. So many people called him later on to be the moral conscience of our times. 1969, Frankl gave his last lecture at the university in Vienna in the age of 91 years. He only talked about 20 minutes, but he couldn't resist to give and to talk until the end of his life. A year later, he died. Frankl's life can be seen as a fight against reductionism and for humanism, for the tremendous power of human spirit, of freedom, personal responsibility, love and faith, against any collective guilt and against all hate, but for the motivational power of meaning as a survival value, as he has experienced himself. He was often citing Goethe, who summarized his attitude so perfectly by saying, if you take man, and I want to close my presentation with this sentence, if you take man as he is, you make him worse than he is. If you take man as he should be, you make him to what he can be. If you make man as he should be, you make him to what he can be. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We now have a chance, if you need to, you know, stretch your legs, do something else to kind of wake up. Maybe you can use a little self-pinching to keep the blood flowing. But I'd like just to keep the opportunities here. I'll mention one thing quickly because things will close. But Dr. Lingla did bring a summary sheet that might be of some interest. If those of you who have not picked it up, there are some at the back of the auditorium on the way out. So with that proper announcement, we'll now have a chance to ask some questions. Because of the mic difficulties, I'll ask, we'll try and work around the questions with the two mics. So as far as I can tell, we're a little bit tethered here, so we'll just ask people to walk around and just use the aisle, okay? Anyone with any questions that you'd like to start with this evening? Feel free to come up, yes.
I'd like a little more information about the second activity you said on love. How did he define that, or as a
by ourselves? We are to be completed by others, by otherness in general, and this concept is named by Frankl self-transcendence. Only when we are capable to transcend ourselves, our borders, and enter a thou, a you, another person, or enter a commitment, which we can also love in a way, then we become ourselves totally. So without that encounter, without that relationship to others, we are only, let me say, in a simplistic way, half a person, and we are completed by the others. So that's the central tenet of logotherapy, one of the two central tenets. The other one is the self-distancing, that we are capable to come to a distance to ourselves, to our feelings, to our wishes, to our lust, to our drives, and so on, and we can behave to ourselves. This is the inner freedom. And the outer freedom is to devote ourselves to somebody else and to our work and commitments and so on. Thank you for asking.
And is that different from the personal meaning you said in the relationship?
No, this is a personal meaning. A personal meaning means that I personally find this work, this commitment, this person which I can love. Then it is a personal meaning. As a theory, it is only describing it theoretically. Yeah. Thank you. Is there any other question?
As he got old, how did he approach his coming death? Did he talk to you about that?
This is a bit a difficult point. Frankl was always an active person, and he started to suffer that he couldn't read anymore. He suffered from a degeneration of the macula and was almost blind in the last couple of years of his life. And he could only read with difficulty a few words by looking in through a certain angle on a book and with a magnifying glass on it, and so he could read a few words. But he couldn't read a text, and his wife read him texts and so on. And then he became still older, and his heart, he was suffering from a Vorhofflimmern in German, an instability of the heart, of the of the upper part of the heart. Maybe it's that, yeah. And so he became weaker, and he had extra pulses all the time, and he got nervous, and he was an anxious person, and so he was tensed. More and more he got tensed. And then the cardiologist proposed him and said that he has, and he was asking if there is any injury, any chirurgical help, surgery help. And the cardiologist told him that he has the choice either to undergo an operation, a coronary artery operation, or he would become weaker and weaker and fade away. And who knows Viktor Frankl, fading away is not the way he could do. So he decided to undergo a coronary surgery. But the cardiologist was telling him that the chance is not higher than 50% to overcome the operation. And he didn't come over that operation. He never woke up from that operation. And about 2 days later, he died unconsciously. He was very nervous in that unconscious state. Nobody knows if this is a reaction or only a neurological activity, or if he really wanted to terminate his state. He tried to pull off the infusions and so, and then he died.
What was written on his tombstone?
What was written on his tombstone?
On his tombstone is only indicated his name, Viktor Frankl. This is another point. Frankl was so highly honored, honored by the state, honored by the city. He was honorary citizenship, and all honorary citizenships, and there are only few, there are in a lifetime, there are living citizen, honorary citizens, there are only about one or two all the time, not more. And all honorary citizenships, citizens of Vienna, have the right to get a honorary tomb. And but Frankl didn't accept it. He wanted to be buried in the family grave, in a very simple, humble family grave, and there is indicated only the name and the date of birth and death.
The question that I have is, with the rise in the in Nazism in the in Europe, what are psychologists and psychiatrists doing to counter the effects of this hatred and anti-Semitism?
You think in Europe or
in America
too? Yeah. What are psychiatrists and psychologists do against that hatred, anti-Semitism? I really don't know. It was difficult for Frankl himself, because sometimes he has seen this, that his Jewish companions and the Jewish people in Vienna, in Austria, were behaving in a way where they were making themselves, bringing themselves into a ghetto, as he was saying. He was saying, I'm suffering from seeing how my Jewish people, or parts of them, behave themselves as if they want to be ghettoized, okay, to be put into a ghetto. And he was really suffering from that, because he was from that part of Jewish people who claimed a open intercultural exchange, but not being separated, and thus bringing up constructing walls. Any separation makes something different, and these differences are can bring up tensions within a society. And if one is living in a society, and this is an interesting thinking and is very valuable also for North America, I think, and not only for Jewish people, if one is separating and living only in his own community and not being open to what the others do and think and does not interchange, then this brings tension and lays ground for hate. And Frankl was fighted for encounter and openness, and also on a cultural and political level. So he was saying that many reactions against the Jewish people he can understand, because he himself has bad feelings when he sees what is going on and how some of the Jewish behave. On the other hand, he also was a victim of anti-Jewish behavior in Vienna after the war, not so much. There he had undergone many difficulties with the Jewish people, because he was against the collective guilt. And many Jewish people fought it for the collective guilt, and he said, if we hold up that theory or that opinion, then we make so many people guilty, and say guilty who are not guilty, who are not guilty because either they didn't live at that time, or they didn't. Weren't adherents of the party or that movement and so on. There is only a personal guilt for what one personally has done. But you never can say the Americans are guilty, or the Iraqi are guilty, or the Austrians are guilty. This is also a bottom, a soil for new hate. So this is what Frankl was saying and suffering about the anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism and against himself, and where he was suffering for his Semitic brothers and sisters. What do psychologists today against these racisms and so on? I don't see very much. I don't know. Maybe somebody amongst us knows more about it. I can't say. I wouldn't say that in Austria there is a significant anti-Semitism nowadays. I know that a couple of years ago the press was saying different things, but we really couldn't, we cannot find it. And the statistics are saying that we have even less tension against foreigners than, let's say, in Germany or in France. But how could we work better on it? First, as a psychologist, I would say we should work on all what we personally feel to be distant, to be far from us, to be strange, to be unknown in our own lives. We have parts in our own life which we have to get to know, and we have sisters and brothers in the own family, and we don't certainly not talk enough. Most of us don't talk enough in our families. And if we start talking in our families, then we get trained to talk with others. And as long as we talk, we can find understanding and make ourselves better understand. That is, in my opinion, to give just a glimpse on possibilities, and knowing that this is not enough, but just to give an idea how we could start to overcome racism and anti-Semitism and so on. Thank you. Yeah, Frankl and Ellie had one daughter, Gabriela, and she is married with Franz, and they have two children, Katja and Alexander, and Katja has already two children between 4 and 2 years, and Alexander is not yet married, he is about 24, 25 now. Yeah, Ellie is still living in Vienna and gets every day a lot of mail and is answering that mail and gets many people coming to Vienna seeing the Frankls and receiving them, and they have a Frankl archive with many, many tapes. Victor was tape recording almost every lecture and every public lecture, so there are hundreds of tapes, and they are going through, and Alexander is doing this copying of the and registering of the archive, and Gabi studied psychology. But she didn't want to be a logotherapist because she was jealous on logotherapy as being the bigger sister, the greater sister to her, because Victor was devoting to logotherapy much more time than to her. And so she wanted to be close to logotherapy in the psychological field, but she was sure when she is studying psychology in Vienna, she will not hear one word about logotherapy, and it was the case.
Yeah. I'd like to know a little bit about your own personal history, how you got interested in Viktor Frankl and logotherapy.
Thank you. I first heard about logotherapy in high school, and I learned, and I see in my memory still the notebook where I was writing Sigmund Freud and a little bit, and then Alfred Adler and a little bit, and Viktor Frankl and nothing. So the teacher was telling us about Freud and Adler and about Frankl, he was just naming it. This was my first encounter with the name Frankl, and I read some books of Frankl, and then when I started to study in Vienna, I first studied in Innsbruck and then in France and Italy and finished my studies in Vienna, then I went to the lectures of Viktor Frankl. And also together with my former girlfriend, and we had vivacious talks during the whole night, or almost the whole night, after a lecture of Viktor Frankl. And she was explaining me Frankl, but she was studying theoretical physics and history of science, and I was studying medicine and psychology, but I should have known it better. And I made the appearance to know it better, but she has seen that it wasn't the case and has explained me the lectures. This was the starting, and this girlfriend, I was marrying that girlfriend, and she is still my wife, and she's still helping me in understanding a lot of logotherapy and Frankl and all that around. And she's now, later on I convinced her to be a psychotherapist, and she gave up that theoretical stuff of physics and so, and she's now working with real men. I then wanted to write a thesis on logotherapy and asked Viktor Frankl, and he was willing to help me, and said I can come in about a half a year when I have finished all the necessary exams. And he will help me. A half a year later I came up and asked him if he has time now for a first conversation on the thesis. And then he was very harsh and shortcut, and was saying, "What do you think? I have to go to Amsterdam next week. I have to prepare my presentations, and then 2 weeks later I have to go to the United States again." And I said, "Excuse me, I'm calling because you said that I can come, and you like that I do a thesis on logotherapy." "Yes, but I don't. You must understand, I don't have the time for that." And so, I didn't do a thesis with him, and did another one. And then I had a difficult life situation. I had a job, I didn't get it, and I always was looking for a psychotherapeutic training, psychotherapeutic work in the field of logotherapy. Logotherapy was really pleasing to me, and I loved it. And I did some other trainings, and so I remembered a lecture where Frankl was telling about a clinic in Germany where they work with logotherapy, and I was applying there. Had no chance at that time. We didn't have the common market, and so. But the lady there said to me that there is an international congress going on near New York. The second world congress. Not so far. At the moment, I don't remember the city. And I went there, and Frankl wasn't there because he had an operation to undergo. And I was signing in a letter, and when I came back, I thought I will call him and talk to him. I was the only Austrian person in that conference. And so I did, and Frankl was very, very pleased and very gentle at that moment. And he invited me to come to his lecture, and if I wouldn't mind to talk about an hour to the students about this conference. He had a 2 hour lecture, and he would give 1 hour, and I should give 1 hour. And at the end of this hour, we were the best friend. And we started a collaboration and had almost a daily talk to each other. Until 1990, when he stopped the collaboration with me because I did too many developments in logotherapy and existential analysis. And so he separated from our society. He was the honorary director of our society. And he never loved societies, and not even logotherapeutic societies. Always saying these are societies are only founding churches, and then you have the church of the right believers and the church of the wrong believers, and this shouldn't happen in logotherapy, but it happened. And he went out, and this was and he was saying, you do certainly a good job, but it's not that logotherapy which I was founding. And so we have now two different streams in that field. The logotherapeutic in the direct way, as Viktor Frankl told it, and the logotherapy, and we call it now existential analysis, this part which has undergone a development and which is much more psychotherapeutic and psychological than logotherapy. And we see logotherapy more, the strength of logotherapy in the field of counseling, and existential analysis has the strength in psychotherapy. So that is my history with Frankl. It started with a difficulty and it ended with a difficulty. Nevertheless, I am very grateful for all I learned from Frankl, and this was the reason that I was writing that book after he was dead. Thank you.
And thank you, and thank you for the long time. I know, realize very much your time and energy. Thank you again. For those, and at least you'll have to stretch a little bit. For those who are planning to come for the workshop for counselors and therapists tomorrow, there's additional information that you can ask on the way out. And thank you all for your kind attention and for your energy this evening. Good night.